Okay, as John just said, this is Speedy Gonzales, and I thought since we're almost in Mexico, this is quite appropriate here. Also, this question mark has been eliminated by the organizers in the schedule. It actually means to say that I'm talking about some older things covering, which may or may not be unfinished developments. Maybe we can spark some new thinking of it and there can be further progress can be made. All right, so I think each speaker got a sentence like the one you read here on top in this email, and I interpret it in this way, that I'm allowed to make a very subjective review here of only a subset, otherwise we could nothing but review. I cover some, probably for the Lattice QCD community, of the mainstream developments, and who would be surprised, there will be some bias toward cluster methods here. And the outline of the talk, I'll talk about what we actually mean by speed of algorithms, agree on some notation, and then I'll talk about update methods for scalars, for gauge fields, for fermions, as you might expect. I'll drop most references on the way, but in the end there's a page with references which at least can serve as an entry in the various fields, and that will be useful when the talk is on the web, I hope. All right. Speed of Monte Carlo algorithms. So what do we normally do? We equilibrate our system. That is something I won't talk about here. I assume this has been done. And then we take measurements of observables, A, B, and so on. Then we do something called here update, which may be a complicated procedure of several algorithms in a row or whatever. But then we measure again, do another update, and so on. And in this way, from our computer, estimates of observables A, I, B, I, and so on pop out, and each measurement is separated by an operation update. Now, if you have a correct and legal algorithm, the mean value of each of these measurements should be the true value of the observables, which I denote by capital letters A, B, and so on. This average, of course, here done for the ith estimate in my chain, if I average, this must mean that I actually average here over many such Monte Carlo procedures. I imagine an ensemble of such runs, and this is a notion that is useful when we think about the dynamics of various algorithms. From such averaging, you can estimate an autocorrelation function, which is the correlation between the deviation of my estimate from the true value at step I, and at a later measurement, t steps later, and you can also do a mixed autocorrelation function this way between several observables. So as I said, the average here means a dynamical average over many Monte Carlos, with independent random numbers, of course, each time. And only if we have equal Monte Carlo time quantities here under the averaging, this coincides with the usual statistical average for the system that we want to compute. So for equal time averaging, this is independent of the choice of the algorithm, but the autocorrelation time between an estimate and a later one is highly dependent on what we actually do for update, even within the class of correct algorithms for a given system. The standard estimator that we derive from our Monte Carlo simulation is, of course, just the arithmetic mean of our successive estimates, little a bar. And the root mean square deviation of this from the true value is what we derive to estimate our errors. It's given by the variance divided by n over a quantity 2 tau int, which has to do with the autocorrelation. So we beat down the variance not just by the number of measurements, but by the number of measurements on some scale that actually depends on the algorithm. And this is what speedy algorithms are about. So the variance, that is one of these equal time Monte Carlo quantities here. This is the usual thing, the variance, as you normally define it. But this factor, which was relevant for beating down the error, the integrated autocorrelation time, is a sum over this autocorrelation function that I defined over all separations normalized to the variance or its value at separation zero. I should remark here that there are actually several definitions of tau int in the literature, which all agree when the autocorrelation times are large, but if they are short, you can normalize tau int differently. This is the one directly relevant for error estimation, and you see that this factor in total has to be 1 when there are no autocorrelation, because error then is just variance divided by n, error squared actually. So this actually goes to 1/2 if there are no autocorrelations. This may be a bit unnatural. There are other definitions which take it to 0 there, but for large tau they all agree. If you think of this tau int, it was derived from a certain observable A. That's why A appears here. If you look at all possible observables, you may detect the slowest mode that the system has. But this is normally extremely hard to determine numerically for given algorithms. Of course, we don't know any of these autocorrelation functions analytically, so all this also has to be determined numerically. You have to use estimators to get the autocorrelation function, and therefore tau int. So different algorithms have different tau int, so if you want to compare their efficiency, you should also have at least some idea of the error in tau int, which for the original observable means you have to talk about the error of their error. Otherwise, you cannot really meaningfully compare algorithms. And a side remark here is that normally we don't just want the observable mean themselves, but we want to estimate nonlinear functions of observables, like a mass derived from a correlation function. So we normally do this by plugging in our standard estimators into the nonlinear function that we want to estimate of those. This is an error of order 1 over n, and to estimate the statistical errors of such things, we need the autocorrelation matrix, actually. But this will not really concern us here any further. Now, so tau int somehow characterizes how small our error gets by doing many measurements. And of course, the bad thing about all this is, in a limit that we have to take, namely the continuum limit, or that the statistical system goes critical, the correlation length in lattice units, now the physical correlation length, diverges in this limit, and with it, normally, also the autocorrelation time diverges, and the two divergences are normally connected by a formula of this type with critical exponents z and za for the exponential autocorrelation time and for the one referring to a given observable. As you all probably know, for standard local updates, all these exponents tend to be close to 2. Remark here is, if you have not standard algorithms which are not uniform going through the lattice doing some update to each field variable, you have to be careful that in this definition, you have to be precise in which units you actually measure your update time, and this always refers to units which are proportional to the number of lattice sites. So a sweep structure in your update, you do something once to every lattice site. If you don't do that, as in some cluster algorithms, you have to correct for a factor with a factor that makes it, converts it to such units before you can actually derive a z from it. So for instance, in Lattice 2001, Ukawa put forward a formula for the cost of lattice QCD simulation. The variation of autocorrelation time or cost of simulations, if you vary A but keep fixed all the physics, all the masses, and so on. And he said there that this is a cost of a^-7. So there are 4 powers from the volume coming from this sweep structure, and that means that the critical exponent z in that case would be 3. And as we all know, in dynamical fermion simulation, there's a very large prefactor in front of this, especially when you try to get smaller quark masses. The fact that you have such a law here is reminiscent of the renormalization group, which normally produces such homogeneous scaling laws. And indeed, also for these dynamical quantities, there's something like a dynamical renormalization group. So one can think about universality classes of algorithms. Of course, one has to specify then what defines a universality class. I think this theory is really not as well developed as the standard renormalization group, and it's also not so important for us here in this context. The practical upshot is that you want algorithm which for a given time that you need to do update on your computer minimizes the integrated autocorrelation time for the quantity or several quantities that you want to measure. in general, it seems that the same algorithms are good for several observables that we normally look at, but in principle, this is an observable-dependent optimization problem. Okay, here comes the first group of fields, scalar fields, and actually I talk mainly about nonlinear sigma models. This is where the classical, by now classical cluster algorithms were successful. They started with Swenson and Wang from Ising and Potts models and could be generalized for O-N sigma models. So for O-N sigma models, one practically or truly, we don't really know to which precision, you always get these exponents only with a large error, but in a practical sense, you find ZA equal to zero for relevant observables in these models, which means in practical terms that you can, at least in two dimensions where you have correspondingly large lattices, you can run physical correlation length on your lattices of order 100 with an autocorrelation time of order 1. So it costs you order site operations to produce an independent estimate of your observables. While before the advent of these methods, doing local methods, there was pretty much a brick wall at correlation length 5 to 10. And I think John spent a lot of time running against the brick wall in those days. So how can this be? Let's talk a little bit how this works. Of course, not in details. You cannot really program from the explanation that I give to you here. But let's discuss the idea. So here's the partition function for a nonlinear O-N nonlinear sigma model in any dimension in principle. The spin variables are unit vectors on the n-dimensional sphere. So the first step is when I have a given field configuration in this model, I have to consider a possible set of new field configurations, which I call target set here. In a local algorithm, you consider just changing one spin. But in these methods, you decompose your spin field with respect to a randomly chosen direction, a different one in each step, into a perpendicular and a parallel component. And what you actually update is the sign of the parallel component in the random direction. So you embed an Ising variable, which is this sign of the parallel component, which for the starting configuration from which you update has certain values plus or minus 1. And you consider choosing a new field value for these Ising variables, and then you go on and do the whole thing again. The choice of the Ising field in this update step proceeds via an effective Hamiltonian, which gives you the energy change when you flip these signs but hold the original S field fixed. So the energy dependence on these Ising sign variables, it has the form of a random bond ferromagnet, and the random bonds is given by the absolute value of the product of the parallel components of neighboring spins. So the important point here is that the model, the effective embedded Ising model that you update, have no frustration. All these J variables are positive, but they have random values. That doesn't hurt you, but it's not a spin glass. Yes, that is one global direction with respect to which you split this field. So now you can update from the initial sigma field that you inherit from the S field to any new value of this spin field with any old algorithm for this effective Hamiltonian H tilde. And you can then prove that the overall procedure for the ON field obeys detailed balance. This method becomes powerful if you update this embedded Ising fields with Swenson-Wang or also the single cluster algorithm closely related versions. So how does that proceed? Let's look at one bond. On one bond, we have the coupling between a spin at the one end sigma and sigma prime at the other end with some random bond strength beta times j. So on this one bond, the essential trick of classical cluster method is this absolutely trivial identity. You write this bond contribution to the Boltzmann factor as a superposition of two terms labeled by a variable b, a bond variable, which you give value 0 or 1 or on and off. And you write it as a superposition of this term and the second term here. and that this is an identity, so you simply check because sigma times sigma prime can only have these two values, and the two coefficients here have been adjusted such that this is an identity. So you introduce now additional redundant variables on the bonds, and for a given spin configuration, you can throw these bonds according to the relative probabilities of these delta, Kronecker delta for B, and then you have a bond configuration. Now, with this bond configuration, you have effectively replaced the original ferromagnetic interaction between spins by either this term, which from the point of view of the spins looks like beta equal to zero, it doesn't care about the spin orientation, or you have replaced it by the second term, which from the point of view of the spins is like beta equal infinity. This is an absolute constraint. So instead of a ferromagnetic interaction that has some tendency to align spins, you have either one that doesn't care about the spins or one that forces the spins to be the same. After you have thrown these bond variables, each interaction of the spins is either of this type or of this type. And now what you have to sort out is which spins are connected by such type of interactions, bonds which forces them to be the same. Then you get groups of spins which are connected or chained together by the constraint, but the groups are completely independent, and in the next step you can choose independent value of each of these groups or clusters. Throwing the bonds factorizes overall links. It's absolutely trivial. Choosing new spins for each cluster is also trivial. The clever part of this algorithm is to get the percolation clusters from the bond configuration, which is absolutely identical to the problem of bond percolation as such, as a geometrical critical phenomenon. So this can be realized rather quickly, and it leads to this remarkably small autocorrelation times. So of course we want to understand why is this efficient. And one way to look at it that I like is the following. You can derive from this procedure an identity exactly which tells you that the spin correlation function, which if you have a mass gap, it decays exponentially with a mass gap, actually coincides with the expectation value taken over bond and spin variables of a function which I didn't care to write down because it's something that is smoothly varying having to do with the perpendicular spin components. But the important point here in this version of estimator of the correlation function is the cluster incidence function, which is simply one if these points are in the same cluster and zero otherwise. This means the exponential falloff of this correlation function is given by a size cutoff in the occurring cluster sizes. And in this sense, I mean, these clusters have all sizes, but their mean size is actually directly related to the correlation length in this way. So we do updates which have the geometrical size of the correlation length, and that is always a good thing to have, I guess, heuristically. Of course, after going through this wonderful time where we suddenly could do simulations very close to the continuum limit, there was a big disappointment because naively we thought, okay, now we do this for SU3 gauge theory, there will be some similar method, and that's it. But we did not even find analogous successful algorithms for sigma models, which from the physics point of view, you would think are very similar to the ON model, like RPN, CPN, or the principal chiral models. For all these models, there's no successful generalization, at least as far as I can see, of these methods. So, of course, it's interesting to try to understand why is this so? And this is perhaps where people can also continue to think and work on this. Well, if you look at, for instance, principal chiral models for a while, you can find easing embeddings. You can find embedded easing variables to some sort of flips in that spin manifold. But if you derive the effective spin Hamiltonian for these embedded variables, then you always find that they are frustrated. You cannot really argue that this is an unfrustrated model. Even for such frustrated systems, you can envisage cluster update procedures, but what happens there is usually the mode in which all these approaches fail is that the clusters are too large. What they end up doing is you do cluster flips which are very similar to just a global symmetry move of the whole field. I mean, clusters do form numerically, and some of the spins are left out, so you do not do exactly global moves, but they have the size of the system, typically. And then you do almost a symmetry transformation, and this is obviously not what is dynamically relevant. It kills the mean value of your order parameter, which is physically correct in any finite volume, but it doesn't do the correct updates on all scales, and in particular not on the scale of the correlation length. And also, due to these properties, you can, of course, not prove an improved estimator identity of the same type as we have in the ON model. Well, the experience is simply, I think in, yeah, sure. I mean, if you want to simulate the model very closely to strong coupling, you may get to a spin model that you can update efficiently. But with the sigma models that I mentioned, and if you tune a beta that gives you, say, a correlation length of 5 or 10, we always found too much frustration in the embedded model. It was spin glass-like. For which systems? Okay, there's another more mathematical argument by Alan Sokol and co-workers. That goes as follows. Think of the ON model as having smooth fields S of X, which actually we know they're not really that smooth, even at large correlation length, but let's think of this. Then if you investigate these cluster formation or bond formation probabilities, you notice that clusters tend to break where this random bond strength in the embedded easing model is very small, and that happens where the parallel component of the spin happens to be zero. So if you think of a smooth spin field and the condition S parallel of X is zero, this is one real condition of X, and generically this generates a D minus one dimensional hypersurface in your originally D dimensional X space. So this is enough to really separate the clusters into volume pieces. In these other embeddings, you have to fulfill several conditions for the clusters to break simultaneously. So the surfaces of the cluster are lower dimensional hypersurfaces, and that is not enough to isolate them from each other and would explain why they're always too large. And in this framework of thinking, somewhat classically, they came up with a no-go theorem, which says that the kind of flips that we embedded into the sphere for the ON sigma model don't really exist in all these other spin manifolds. There are no such mappings that can be connected to an easing spin, and that's why you cannot really find such algorithms there. Okay, here's just a picture of an XY model simulation. I think five largest clusters are colored, and then there are black spins. These are actually not one cluster. The black ones are all the remaining ones, which also form very many small clusters. This is correlation length 40, so it's squeezed somewhat into a finite box. And the flip direction was vertical here, and if you meditate a while on this figure, you can start to think that predominantly the cluster boundary spins tend to be somewhat horizontal. All right, so no cluster algorithms, for instance, for CPN model. But over the years, rather interesting and very indirect and creative way out has emerged, where you make use of actually the large freedom that we have in discretizing spin systems, if we are only interested in the continuum limit. And this works via quantum models, cluster updates for quantum models. In quantum models, you start from a Hamiltonian formulation of the system. So you have a little d-dimensional Hamiltonian operator, like in real life that would be three-dimensional. And then you use the Trotter-Suzuki formula to map such an operator onto a little d plus one, which I call capital D dimensional classical formulation, essentially by doing the transition from a Hamiltonian to a path integral as Feynman did. And this is somewhat similar to Euclidean field theory, although, of course, you don't have Euclidean invariance, but you have a summation or integration over classical field variables. So the prototype of this method starts, for instance, treats the quantum Heisenberg model in one dimension. Now you have at each lattice site a spin operator, nearest neighbor coupling, and the operators obey an algebra like this, SU2, but they only non-commute, they're only non-commuting when they're sitting at the same lattice site. And then the Trotter formula uses a breakup of the Hamiltonian. This is analogous in the ordinary path integral. You break up into kinetic and potential term. Here you take the even links and the odd links, and the rationale of this is now that within H1, there are only terms which commute with each other. The same is true for H2. So that is relatively easy to exponentiate. And then the error that you make here goes away if you take epsilon to zero and to infinity such that the product remains beta. So this is the standard way of getting from a quantum model to a classical model. Now, from all these many factors, e to the minus epsilon H1 and H2, you introduce intermediate states, again, as for the Feynman path integral. Here you use eigenstates of the spin operator, three component, for instance, with eigenvalues plus minus 1/2. And then your model is classical. You sum now over all the values that characterize the inserted intermediate states, and their product of all these transition amplitudes, they give you a weight for these classical configurations. So this has brought the Heisenberg model, for instance, to a classical form. It's now a two-dimensional classical system. The amplitudes A in this case can be shown to be larger or equal to zero. A slight problem is actually that many of them are zero. Many configurations here don't really occur of intermediate state spin variables. More precisely, because the Hamiltonian conserves the total spin, the sites where spin is 1/2, they cannot simply flip to minus 1/2 and this spin vanishes, but it has to move. They can only exchange their spin. And this is how you get a world line picture of such a classical system corresponding to the quantum Heisenberg model. These lines follow the spin 1 plus 1/2 sites, and the other ones are minus 1/2. So here you have a model which, at least in a scaling limit, should produce a continuum physics too. These models are very hard for local algorithms because typically, as you want to move this bowl of spaghetti world lines, if you want to deform them locally, you run through a configuration that has weight zero, which you are not allowed to take. So local algorithms are no good for this, but this is another field where cluster algorithms were found, which were very successful for these models, the so-called loop cluster algorithms devised by these people. And without talking about details here, I just mentioned that also here, again, the interaction terms, which are implied by the Trotter-Suzuki factors, they are stochastically decomposed into something like bonds and non-bonds. And then after doing such a stochastic change of the interaction variables, so to speak, you can identify closed loops which can become large, on which the spin number can be flipped from between plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. So you do this and you find that you have an efficient update procedure for this kind of models. And as a matter of fact, it works both for the Heisenberg ferro and antiferromagnet, and you get very high precision results with these kind of simulations. But it took another very clever step by Uwe Wiese and collaborators to make this into a cluster simulation of CPN models, which was unsuccessful in the classical way. They did the following chain of steps. They first devised in two space dimensions, so two-dimensional Hamiltonian quantum spin system that has a global SUN symmetry which spontaneously breaks down to UN minus one. So the Goldstone bosons in this system are in the manifold, in the quotient manifold SUN over UN minus one, which happens to be CPN minus one. So this is what happens in two infinite space dimensions, spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now they make one of these two dimensions finite, so they go to a stripped geometry. Then the Mermin, Wagner, Coleman, or whatever order theorem tells you that the continuous symmetry cannot break down spontaneously anymore. So no real symmetry breakdown, but what happens is that a very small mass is generated as a finite volume effect, so to speak, for the would-be Goldstone bosons. And actually, this mass corresponds to a correlation length that always makes the finite direction that we introduced here look short, such that effectively the model reduces in dimension to from a two-dimensional to a one-dimensional quantum model, or if you trotterize it, it becomes a two-dimensional classical model. So by this rather indirect technique, they get the CPN minus one model clusters simulated as the effective theory, like chiral perturbation theory, of this would-be Goldstone molds, which get a finite, small finite mass, which is the mass gap that has to be generated in the CPN minus one model. And you say that you might think this is very complicated. Can you really get precision in this way? In fact, they did. They checked the universality that they get the right kind of model, really, by comparing in detail finite size scaling properties of this model with standard discretized model, both for CPN minus one, as far as you can simulate it with standard methods, and with the O3 model, where you can do a high precision comparison. So in this very indirect method, these people succeeded in the end to simulate CPN minus one model, and probably they can also do other models. Actually, to some degree, this quantum model approach even extends to fermion. I'll get back to that, hopefully. And they are also heavily working on constructing gauge theories from quantum link models. As far as I know, there are not yet any high precision simulations in this field, but the ideas are actually there. So from this rather exotic applications of cluster method, let's for a while now go to everyday standard things, namely what do we do with pure gauge systems? So what is the typical update underlying quenched calculation? I would say the standard procedure there is what I like to call hybrid over-relaxation methods. I discuss it only for gauge group SUN because for SU2, because when you have SU3 or larger N, you can update via embedded SU2 variables by the Khabibu-Marinari mapping. This may not be the ideal method for N going to infinity. This is really not what I had in mind when I wrote this transparency. But for SU3, this is the standard way to proceed. And I also restrict myself here to actions where the single link dependence of any individual link that you update is of this form, exponential real part trace of the link U that you want to update, and something, some matrix M given by the surroundings. And since you are now in SU2, you can write the link matrix in this quaternion form, parameterize it with a four-dimensional unit vector, and then this becomes like, in a spin model, a scalar product between your U-spin, so to speak, that characterizes your link, and the environment, which is some four-component vector M. This includes many actions, the standard Wilson-Plaquette action, of course, also Iwasaki and Szymanczyk-type action. But there are counterexamples which are not included here. For instance, if you have a piece of adjoint in your action that you write as a square of the fundamental U variables, this would not be of this type. but most actions that we simulate are of this type. So what can you do now? You do a local update. Heat bath means you generate the little U that characterizes your link with this distribution. That can be done essentially in closed form. But the important point to accelerate such simulations is a microcanonical step that can also be done. It's often called overrelaxation, although overrelaxation in principle is a more general concept. It's really a microcanonical step where you move, you do again a decomposition into a parallel and perpendicular part for your use, as before in the cluster method, but now the direction is given to you by the environment variable n, and you flip the perpendicular part to minus itself. So this is a move, obviously, which does not change the energy because that depends only on the scalar product. And the other components, I guess you just move them as far as you can to make a large step. So hybrid overrelaxation now is a compound of updates where you do a heat bath sweep to all links, followed by a certain number of these microcanonical steps, which are generally called overrelaxation sweeps. So this number is called NOR. And with this method, empirically, it has been found that by some tuning, you can achieve effectively dynamical critical exponents of around 1. But to really get this, you have to make this fraction of overrelaxation steps larger and larger as the system becomes more critical. So for those of you who know the real overrelaxation procedure there, you have a tunable parameter. In the limit omega going to 2, it becomes really a microcanonical, and there the analogous tuning is that you choose omega to be 2 minus something that goes to 0 as the correlation length diverges. And here this is sort of mimicked in an incoherent fashion by doing one sweep like this and many sweeps like this. So in fact, this has been found, at least by the Alpha collaboration, where we simulate in finite volume, which we keep fixed in physical units. We can vary the lattice spacing quite a bit, and we verify that you can get to such values. A little technical point on the way, we found that actually it is this loop order of doing these microcanonical updates is much better than the opposite one, for reasons that I don't really... some correlation length. There are three coefficient here. It is only proportional to this. Well, you have to find this proportionality constant experimentally anyway. So. So at the end of the day, then, in most of these quenched calculation, this update is efficient enough to achieve that the update time is completely negligible compared to the whole effort. So people tend to just make many update steps such that their estimates are effectively independent, and then they compute complicated quenched observables, which usually takes more time than the update. So here one is relatively happy, at least at today's criticality that one achieves. Side remark here, also for gauge theories, there are some rudimentary efforts to do cluster simulations, because let's think of Z2 gauge theories. And of course, this trick of writing the ferromagnetic interaction as a superposition of beta 0 and beta infinity constraint terms, this, of course, can be immediately generalized here. So this you can also do for a Z2 gauge theory. And then the next step is, of course, after throwing these bonds, that you have to find a random gauge field that obeys the constraints that are given on some of the plaquettes. This is the hard step here. It's analogous to the cluster search in the spin model. For the three-dimensional Z2 model, there's a very efficient graph theoretical solution by Benaf and other people. And Bunk has actually put forward a more general solution, which works by linear algebra. you actually map this constraint equation to a system of linear equations in the field of two elements, which is isomorphic to Ising variables. And there you can do Gaussian elimination and find the most general spin configuration that obeys all these Plaquette constraints and choose one of them at random. These algorithms achieve a Z of about a half in these gauge models. But nice as this is for Z2 variables, the next step, namely use the Z2 variables as embedded spins in some other gauge model, that has not succeeded, that has not been achieved, so they have been useful only for Z2. Yes, although I should say that the duality transformation does not work configuration by configuration, so you cannot really get this algorithm from the cluster algorithm of the Ising model, and some observables... Yes, but some observables are accessible in the one model and some are in the other model. I mean, they. But of course, it's not that with this algorithm we can simulate three-dimensional Z2 theories, and without it we cannot. It's more an algorithmic remark that I'm making here. Sorry? Wundt's method works in four dimensions, but in four dimensions, of course, the Z2 gauge theory is nowhere critical. But he has this generalization also to include Z2 Higgs fields, and there you can simulate a critical endpoint in that phase diagram. Yes, but only in lattice proceedings of ancient times, but I can give you the reference. Okay, there's some recent progress by people in Zurich. Philippe de Foncamp probably knows more about these methods. From reading the paper, it has not yet become clear to me if this is really a generally fast algorithm or not, but they managed to do updates which change some flux loops in a U1 gauge theory in three dimensions directly without using this or embedding. Okay, dynamical fermions. So we heard in two other talks a lot about chiral invariant quarks. I have nothing to say about this. But here are more the standard quarks, the path integral of QCD with the gauge part of the action and some quark bilinear. What I call the determinant method, you immediately integrate out these Grassmann variables. Usually one makes a joke saying that we don't have data type Grassmann in our Fortran compiler. So we can only integrate them out, have the determinant, and then use this formula, and you only integrate over gauge field. The next step, when you have this determinant in your Boltzmann factor, is to write this as a path integral again over pseudo fermions, and I take here an f equal 2. I have now a minus sign problem, and I take pseudo Hermitian Dirac operators. So the operator Q, which sneaks in a gamma phi here, is a Hermitian operator. And the determinant that we have to compute is that Q squared, which can be written in this way as in a pseudo-fermion representation. The standard workhorse to do such simulations now with the pseudo-fermions is, of course, hybrid Monte Carlo, where you introduce conjugate momenta to the gauge fields. And you have an action of U, which consists of the gauge part and the pseudo-fermion part. So the update you do there is a global heat bath for phi. You just generate a phi configuration in one shot. Then you do an update almost microcanonical on pi and U. That is, you solve the Hamiltonian equation. If they were not discretized, this would be microcanonical. Since they are discretized, you have to do this accept-reject step. General remarks here. Hybrid Monte Carlo is an exact algorithm including fermions. We are familiar with this by now, but at some point this was a celebrated result. Before we had all kind of microcanonical algorithms only where the step size had to be controlled and so on. On the other hand, hybrid Monte Carlo for the gauge part alone is a relatively slow algorithm compared to the standard hybrid overrelaxation that I introduced before. Here's actually a plot that a PhD student of mine has produced a few years ago. what are we seeing here? This is a simulation of the Schrödinger functional, and think of it as the various lattice sizes are L over A here, and the simulations are such that the physical size L is kept fixed in the form of the renormalized coupling associated with the Schrödinger functional. So, and along this axis, you can interpret this as really varying A alone and keeping L fixed in physical units. So it's really a scaling study. On this axis, we have something called S cost, which is a measure of the number of operations that you have to do to get a certain observable, namely this renormalized coupling, to a certain accuracy of 1% or something. So this is a unit in which you can compare different algorithms. And the various algorithms here, the location of their cost is actually the bar under the letters. That is the height in S cost of these various algorithms at various lattice spacings. So the lowest bars belong to hybrid over-relaxation here. And through this value, I drew a line corresponding to the slope z equal 1 and to the slope z equal 2. And you see here, although this is only in a certain range and the scaling laws are only asymptotic, that you see pretty much that z equal 1 has been achieved here for hybrid over relaxation. You see here that hybrid Monte Carlo, which has actually been optimized here for the system to some degree, lies somehow between z equal 1 and z equals 2, but the main message is it's between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude more expensive here. The other algorithms you see here is just plain heat bath that is here. It actually also scales relatively well at these lattices. And this is local hybrid Monte Carlo, which I don't want to discuss in detail here. So hybrid Monte Carlo costs a factor 30 or 40 more than hybrid over relaxation for the gauge part alone. Keep that in mind because I'll come back to that. Some recent improvements on hybrid Monte Carlo and the standard method. One is a really minor technical thing, which is a byproduct of Lüscher's recent papers on domain decomposition. It's really unrelated to the main subject. But when you do hybrid Monte Carlo, you usually have to exponentiate the randomly chosen momenta to turn the Lie algebra into Lie group values. He remarked here that this does not really have to be an exact exponential to have an exact algorithm. So this step, which can make some headache in general, could be replaced by something that is realized by a closed function. You just need square roots and so on. It also works through SU2 subgroups. So that would be, if you program a hybrid Monte Carlo today, you may want to make use of that. It was mentioned by Tony and by Kostas in more detail yesterday, the Hasenbusch trick. That was some progress in recent times. It can be brief about this now. At small quark mass, you have a large condition number in q⁻¹, which leads to large forces in your hybrid Monte Carlo, which forces you to take a small step size. Hasenbusch's trick is to write the determinant, the relevant determinant, as two factors, or in principle, you can also do more factors, of some operator that you insert here, completely what you want. It is canceled immediately again here, so the determinant product doesn't change. But you can achieve, you can choose operators here such that when you introduce for each of these determinant its own pseudo-fermion, the total force gets smaller and you can take larger step size. In the Alpha collaboration, we realized this for the Q corresponding to the Wilson operator with Clover term, even not preconditioned even. And we used Q twiddle here as the original Q, which is Hermitian, shifted in an imaginary direction. And then you end up with a pseudo-fermion action which has these two terms. This is now, due to the addition of rho squared in here, an operator which is much better conditioned than Q squared itself. This one here also leads to a smaller force because this quadratic form here is better conditioned, but to evaluate it, you need the inverse of Q. So that costs the same as before, but the effect in the hybrid Monte Carlo still is a smaller force. So we choose a value of rho here that makes the condition numbers of this quadratic form and of this about the same. In the meantime, we learn that actually it's better to do something different, namely to choose the division such that you can have a larger step size on this part where the evaluation of the operator is expensive. By and large, in particular, QCDSF has worked on that and published numbers, and they report gains of the factor 2 to 6 just from this cheap trick. It really requires a very minor modification of any hybrid Monte Carlo code that you have to have, that you happen to have, I meant to say. All right. So these were the standard methods, which are improving by some factors again and again. But I want to mention a few other approaches still. First of all, you can do the determinant but not introduce pseudo-fermions that we have seen in a few cases for chemical potential here. But you also can do this in general from the following motivation. Since we just saw that hybrid Monte Carlo for the gauge part is much worse than hybrid orelaxation, we might dream of a fermion algorithm which, in the limit that the fermions go away, really approaches this good algorithm that we know for pure gauge field. What? No, but even if you don't take this limit, if it has such a good limit, it may also be better before you take this limit. It's just the limit that you, it's just the guiding principle how you can now look at other fermion algorithms, which I will do now. I don't know. Anyway, a trivial way to realize such an algorithm is that you make a proposal with your beloved hybrid orelaxation algorithm, which has to be symmetrized in a way that this has really detailed balance, and then you could think of putting the whole determinant into an accept-reject step. It's one possible algorithm. And actually, for the proposal, you wouldn't even have to use just the physical gauge action. You could use some modified proposal here, and whatever differs in the total action, you can put this into the exact reject step. This is called ultraviolet filtering. The most simple realization would be to use a different beta here and change beta also in the exact reject step. The problem, of course, is that this proposal doesn't know anything of the fermions. It's not a fermion-guided proposal. So a big question is, of course, is the acceptance acceptable in this case, even if you can do the determinant exactly on some small lattice or in two dimensions. So this is what's also called the overlap problem in other talks. The answer most certainly is in general no, although I think this is known really in connection with pseudo-fermions, that is a stochastic realization of the change of the determinant, which may also cost acceptance. But I guess in general the answer is no, but in the Schrödinger function we are at least sometimes interested, Schrödinger functional, we are sometimes interested also in physically small volumes where the gauge fields are smoother than in large volumes. And it could be that there, where the system becomes eventually perturbative, the determinant, after all, is a one-loop effect, and it may be a small effect in this limit. We tried out this method among other things, with an exact evaluation of the determinants in the Schwinger model, Francesco Knechtli and myself, and we're not the first to find this, actually. In this model, you can do perfectly a simulation like this if you have an exact estimate of the change of the determinant. You can even make the proposal of the gauge field by a global heat bath completely independent of the earlier history, and you can achieve a decent acceptance rate there. In that model, we also learned that when you do a stochastic estimate of the determinant change of this factor in your Boltzmann weight, this always costs acceptance. That's actually an exact inequality which shows that the stochasticity in this step, if this word exists, I don't know, costs you acceptance. And you can improve this if you have a few generalized eigenvalue in this problem, where you have here the fermion operator in the proposed new gauge field, and here in the old gauge field, and here the relative eigenvalue, so to speak, in this generalized eigenvalue problem. If you know a few extremal eigenvalues of this type, for instance, by a Lanczos procedure, then you can make use of them and increase the acceptance. And if you have all of them, you're doing the exact determinant. So if you compute, or if you're able to compute such eigenvalues, you can interpolate between exact determinant and stochastic estimates for the determinant. In two dimensions it works. In four dimensions, I guess it will work only in small volume. We haven't yet really tried it. It would be nice to see up to which volume it works. Okay, let me know about that. Okay, this was no pseudo-fermions. You can also think about actually living without the determinant. After all, the Grassmann integral on any finite lattice is a finite sum of non-zero terms. It's a way of drawing graphs on the lattice, if you like. So a legitimate question is certainly, can this be sampled directly? And what comes immediately to your mind, since these numbers anti-commute, with a very large probability to you run full power into this minus sign problem. But there are some examples, at least, where this can be circumvented. Well, one very old example that I was involved in was lattice QCD at zero beta. This is one of the cases where I like to look at staggered fermions because you have only one Grassmann component per site. At beta equals zero, this is the partition function of strong coupling QCD. Now, in this model, you can first integrate U link by link. Since the model is gauge invariant, it also has to be gauge invariant after the U variables are gone. The model does this because it becomes a purely Grassmann formulated model in terms of local variables which are psi bar psi and become gauge invariant side by side. I call this ultra-local confinement happening at beta equals zero. So in the next step, the resulting Grassmann integral can also be done. It cannot be done to the degree that you simply evaluate the number that is z, but it can be done in the sense that you can enumerate all the contributing terms by another statistical system, a so-called monomer-dimer system. That is, you can exactly transform now this partition function into something where you have variables on the links which run through integers from 0 to n. This is a weight for each link. These numbers are known. I just didn't bother to write them down. And then there are additional terms at the sites which depend on some secondary field sigma of x. Sigma of x essentially just calls how many of these dimers are adjacent to link x, n minus this number. This is the number of monomers at site x, and they are the mass m is exponentiated with these. So this is an exact transformation to this discrete model. And this can also, I should have mentioned this, what I just discussed was for un. If you do sun, you get additional polymer variables. But in any case, local updates of these dimers, you want to change the dimer number on a given link, it's only possible for m equals zero. Otherwise, local updates again face the problem of having to go through zero weight configurations. But recently, there has been some progress made by Adams and Chandrasekaran. So they found also for this model a non-local cluster algorithm which works even at m equals zero. So this is also one of the cases you may not want to set m exactly to zero on a finite lattice, but an algorithm that works very well in this limit also is efficient at small m. So this is a good progress. And what they did only un as far as I know. They made a precision study because also in this model at strong coupling, you actually have chiral symmetry breakdown, you have a finite temperature transition, and they studied this, they compared it with chiral perturbation theory, and they get an amazingly high precision agreement there, but of course it's still beta equals zero, not continuum QCD. But there are other non-determinant methods. They start again, as I mentioned earlier, from a Hamiltonian formulation of a fermionic system, d-dimensional fermion Hamiltonian, Trotter-Suzuki transformation to turn it into a classical model. Now the natural intermediate states to take in a fermion system are those characterized by occupation numbers. So then again, they get a world line gas one can get a world line gas by such formulation, by such tricks. It's a very old way of rewriting partition functions. And in general, you hit the minus sign problem related to the possible topologies of the world lines. And if you put it into the observable, the only thing that you comes to your mind most of the time, this doesn't work, as we know. But the group, again, around Uwe Wiese and Charlie Shangasekaran, they managed to overcome this actually for a class of models which is not quite the Hubbard model, but closely related to it, by the Meron cluster technique. That is a technique, again, using the cluster method, similar to the loop cluster algorithm somewhat, and it achieves the analytical combination of configurations with positive and negative weights in such a way that the resulting groups of configurations that you then sample have positive or zero weights. And since there are a lot of zero contribution to their observables, they need some additional tricks, but they can simulate this model very efficiently. But these methods work for certain models. They require a clever construction case by case. And recently by Troya, who is here at the moment, and Uwe Wiese, there was a paper warning that in generally this sign problem may not be solvable. But in some cases, they have done it. So it's difficult to draw a general conclusion there. Anyway, I can draw a conclusion of this talk. The classical cluster algorithms are restricted to ON and discrete models. There's some progress via quantum models. So one can think of very non-standard discretization with a view on the possible algorithms available. There is certainly steady progress for the standard fermion method via things which proceeds via determinant and pseudo-fermions and hybrid Monte Carlo type algorithm. The optimized solvers, integration schemes, preconditioning two or more pseudo-fermions, domain decomposition put forward by Lucia recently, and there will be more such things. The only thing is that I cannot really see that this leads to any breakthrough type gains as the advent of the classical cluster algorithm did in the past, but probably we simply cannot have that for QCD. But maybe we could still, from time to time, at least some of us, invest some time of looking for such representations which are different from the usual non-local bosonization. And I guess the idea would be to think of cluster methods from the beginning when you look for such alternative representations. But clearly, this is a long way to go for QCD, and it may also never get there. So this was the speculative part. And here's the reference sheet, which I guess is more useful when it's on the web. Thank you. Well, I think in their original form, with really introducing many pseudo-fermions, they have not really been very useful because this leads to long autocorrelation times because these many fields have a large inertia, so to speak, when you update the gauge field at fixed pseudo-fermion fields. They cooperate to hold back the gauge field. But in another form, which is called polynomial hybrid Monte Carlo, the method has been more useful. In particular, it has been useful to us in Alpha to on purpose deviate from important sampling. For instance, to sample configurations with small eigenvalues more than they would occur. Of course, this has to be compensated in the observables, but for some things that we want to measure, overall this leads to smaller variance. But this is, I think, what I know about these methods and their present role. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think actually when CPPAX does three flavors, they use such a method for the strange quark. But it cannot really handle a sign change in that determinant. So the mass has to be large enough such that this never happens. But I mean, you cannot invert with a polynomial when zero is in the spectrum, right? So you have to exclude some range of the spectrum there, and then I don't know how you achieve that. It actually tunnels through that range to change the sign, but. Okay, so you answered your question.
However, you mentioned on Monday that it will be useful for the canonical ensemble approach for finite density when you need a full determinant to avoid the overlap. So that's where I think it will probably have some use for.
But I guess this will be restricted to small lattices forever.
No, no. We use a noisy Monte Carlo. In fact,